The Girl in the Plane, read by Katherine Center. Firefighters don't get as many calls as you might expect for fighting fires. 90% of our calls, in fact, are for other things. Mostly they're medical. Chest pain, car accidents, ODs. Kidney stones are big these days. An astonishing number are for genuinely stupid things, little things that no one should ever call 911 for. Toothaches, headaches, toe cramps, hangnails. We once got a call for a missing earlobe. It's like nobody got the memo that emergency services are for emergencies. That's not even the crazy stuff. We get calls all the time for ghost sightings. We get calls for lost car keys, impolite neighbors, forgotten Wi-Fi passwords, nightmares. There's a whole subset of the population that dials 911 for any problem they can't solve in 5 minutes. A guy called in one time demanding that we come to his house and tell his mother she needed to respect him. A lady once faked a heart attack so she could get a ride across town to take her kids to the zoo. One guy called us for a skunk hiding behind his toilet tank. And let's not forget the woman who wanted us to move a sofa for her. And when we told her that was not our job, she called the cops to complain. All to say, real emergencies are not the bulk of our business. And so when we get a real call for an actual life and death situation, we're excited. This is what we're trained to do. This is what we're here for. Not to bring you dental floss, to save you, if we can. I don't know how to say it without sounding heartless, and maybe it's something you can really only understand after you've seen far too many tragedies up close, but it's the really bad calls that we look forward to. The calls that matter. Or, at the very least, the calls that aren't Elvis sightings. So all that said, I'll confess that when we got the call for a plane crash at Seeger Airfield, I was kind of stoked. A plane crash. Cool. I could check another type of rescue off my firefighter bucket list. I'd never worked a plane crash before. The tones went off through the station just as we were sitting down to supper. Medic 2, Ladder 4, Engine 16, District 4, respond to civilian plane crash at Seeger Airfield. No visible fire. That was us. Engine 16, the closest station. Reichman had been smoking a brisket out back since the start of shift that morning, and he was just walking it to the table when the tones went off. So much for the brisket, our captain said, as she grabbed a slice of loose cut and popped it into her mouth. We left the rest on the table under a crumpled piece of tinfoil. 60 seconds later, we were rolling, and we called dispatch for updates. Multiple calls to 911 confirmed that a small private plane had cartwheeled across the runway during landing. Awesome. There's a feeling you get as you head out to a real call that's like nothing else in the world. It's tension, excitement, focus, and the feeling that you're about to do something genuinely important. We'd been dispatched to this field before, but never for an actual crash. Once for a false alarm in the hangar, once for a fuel spill, and once for a guy who got locked in the bathroom. This was different. Riding in the engine, I watched the streets slide by in that otherworldly way they do at the start of a call. It was dusk, and the clouds were threatening rain. At first, the drive was just dreamy and surreal, like always. Children in parks stopped to watch us go by. Even fully grown adults raised their hands to wave as if they were seeing celebrities or maybe just old friends. Then the rain started and everybody disappeared indoors. Has anybody worked a plane crash before? I asked the guys. They're a lot like car crashes, Hernandez said, but with wings, Reichman added. Thanks, I said, flaring my nostrils. After a minute, Big Tom said, I worked that Continental 737 crash back in 98. Then he added, it wasn't pretty. Just as we arrived at the field, the rain stopped as fast as it had started, a flash storm. One of the reports said the aircraft had lost a wing, and as we pulled up, we saw that was true. It lay like a carcass across the runway, as chunks of scrap metal made a speckled path over to the rest of the plane, which was wedged in a ditch, splayed out all cockeyed. The runway was empty except for a trim man in an Izod shirt, khakis, and an almost comically preppy ribbon belt who was drenched to the skin. He kept waving us down even as we drove toward him and then stopped the engine a few feet away. He was panting and wild-eyed and a little off-kilter, almost the way tipsy people are. I knew on sight that he'd been inside that plane. "There's been an accident," he shouted as we disembarked. "Are you hurt?" I asked, walking toward him. I was the ranking medic. "I lost my cell phone," he said. "Are you injured?" I tried again, putting a hand on him and scanning him from head to toe. But he just said, "Have you seen the fire department? I need to call them." We clearly were the fire department, and he clearly was in shock. I stood there in my bunker gear in front of our shiny red fire engine with its lights flashing, and I said, in a simple tone like I was just telling him an interesting fact, "We are the fire department. No judgment." "Then, was anyone with you?" He frowned and blinked like he was clearing his eyes. Then he looked from me to the fire truck and back, putting it together. Lady plus firefighter. "You're the fire department," he said as it hit him. Not surprising. Shock often prevents people from making sense of things. It's like the world is a puzzle and they can't fit the pieces together. Over by the engine, our EO, the engine operator, was turning on the pump for foam as the rest of the crew deployed hose line toward the wreckage. Because of the fuel spill, we couldn't use water. There was no fire yet, but after an accident like this, any loose wire could spark one. We needed to neutralize that fuel before anything else. That meant lots and lots of foam. I wanted to help the crew, but I needed to triage this guy first. "Are you injured?" I asked again, ready to get some traction this time. At last, he shook his head, seeming to snap enough of reality into place to answer. "I'm fine," he said, taking a step closer. "It's my girlfriend. She's still inside." I turned to the plane. "You have to get her out," he said, more urgent as his awareness sharpened. "Her legs are pinned." An ambulance pulled up behind us, Medic 2. I'd already assessed enough about this guy to know that he didn't need me. Not as much as his girlfriend did, anyway. I met his eyes. "See that ambulance?" I said, pointing. "Go let the medics get a look at you." "I'm completely fine," he said. Maybe he was, or maybe he wasn't. In the wake of a trauma, most folks aren't qualified to judge. Either way, I needed to get him away from that plane, away from danger, and into the safekeeping of professionals. He kept his eyes on the wreck. The crew was in position now to spray the foam. Then he looked at me. "What are you waiting for? Go get her out." "I can't go until we've neutralized the fuel spill." "But she's all alone. She's trapped." I really didn't have time to stand here discussing this. "Sir," I said, "please report to the paramedics." "I can't go," he said. "She needs me." Then he took a step toward the plane, like he was gonna, what, go climb back in? But I blocked him, stepping into his path. As I did, I signaled a round-em-up hand gesture to the paramedics behind him to let them know to come over. He looked straight at me. "She told me not to leave her." "You can't help her right now," I said. "You have to let us do our jobs." "Margaret!" he shouted then, like he was the rescuing hero and I was blocking him, instead of exactly the other way around. Stalling for a second until the medics could reach us, I tried to Jedi mind trick him. I made my voice both soothing and authoritative. "You don't have the tools or the equipment to help," I said. "That wreckage could blow at any minute. We do this all the time. We're very good. The best you can do for your girlfriend is go with these paramedics and let me get back to work." "Fiance," he corrected, as he turned and saw the medics approaching. The sight seemed to panic him. It would have been so easy for him to make things easy for us, but he went the other way. "Margaret!" he shouted again, and then he made a break for the plane. No way was I letting him do that. I grabbed his arm just as he pushed past me, and I twisted him down onto his knees on the concrete in a motion so swift that he turned to blink up at me in bewilderment afterward, like he couldn't understand how he'd wound up down there. "Can't go over there," I said, like I was talking to a toddler. "It's not safe." And then, just as I said it, as if to validate the hell out of what I had just told him, with a soul-grazing whoosh, the plane burst into flames. Reichman and Big Tom had been poised to spray the scene, and so the fire was smothered with foam as soon as it flared up. Nonetheless, it wasn't looking good for the girl in the plane. The sight seemed to defeat the preppy guy. I felt his frame go slack. The medic saw it too and moved in to haul him out of there just as Reichman signaled me toward the wreckage, like, go on, get in there. I snapped my mask into place and entered the smoke. It was white, mixed with steam, but clearing rapidly. I clicked on my flashlight, but within a few steps I didn't need it. I could see the wreckage ahead, hulking and smoke-stained and waiting. The girlfriend might be all right, I thought. Or she might be a charcoal briquette, 50-50. Okay, maybe more like 30-70. Big Tom was right behind me with the cutters, Hernandez had the Halligan tool, and the rest of the crew was moving in to stabilize the hull with cribbing. The way the plane was wedged, we were going to have to pry the roof off to get to her. Luckily, those tiny planes are basically just wrapped in tinfoil. We could have used a can opener if we'd had to. We started prying the metal back. This was the moment when I'd find out if we were doing a rescue or a recovery. I braced myself for any of the possibilities. A fully charred dead body, a semi-charred live body, or, worst-case scenario, a mostly charred live body. If I'm honest, what I really expected to see behind that blackened, burned roof was a blackened, burned corpse. But that's not what I saw. Instead, I found a bright, blonde, 20-something, not charred girl wearing a halter dress, still buckled into her seat, and grinning with utter delight at the sight of me. I love you, she said. And before I could reply, she said, I have literally never been as happy to see anybody in my entire life as I am to see you right this minute. And I am including that time at a restaurant when I accidentally sat one table over from Russell Crowe. It took me a second to respond. Of all the possibilities I'd considered for the state of the victim inside that wreckage, perky and chatty wasn't one of them. Was it possible this girl might walk away from this wreckage totally unscathed? No, it really wasn't. I can't tell you how I knew it exactly, but when you've assessed enough patients, you just start to know things without ever consciously figuring them out. Your senses take in information and add it up into data that you don't even have to read. I knew for certain already that she was much less fine than she seemed. The cockpit smelled like barbecue, for one, which meant she'd been burned somewhere. So much for that brisket dinner. There was something off about the angle of her body, too, notwithstanding the fact that she was buckled sideways in the seat of a plane. A quick glance down at her feet confirmed they were pointing in different directions. Something was wrong. Time to get to work and find out what. I pulled off my mask and hood and shouted, "We have a live patient!" to the guys. "I'm going to need a board and a C-collar, and somebody call for the trauma hawk." When I turned back to her, she was pointing at me in astonishment. "You're a girl," she said. "Yep," I said, my voice all conversational as I assessed her, pupils even, eyes focused, airway clear, and definitely conscious. "I'm so embarrassed," she said next. She gestured at my mask. "I just assumed you were a guy. How sexist of me." I shook my head like, "Don't worry." Then I said, "I get that a lot." "I bet you do," she said. Her voice had that slightly rushed, manic intensity that people often generate when they're trying like hell to return to normal. I let her talk for a minute while I continued my exam. "But it's so cool," she went on, "you being a fireman." Then she corrected herself. "Firefighter, sorry. Bet you get that a lot too. I'm just a little starstruck. It's like seeing a unicorn, a female unicorn. I always knew lady firefighters existed out there somewhere, but I've never seen one. But here we are. Amazing. I feel like I should ask for your autograph, maybe. Would that be weird? Because this has been the most crazy-ass day ever, but I sort of feel like if I could get an autograph from a unicorn, that just might make it all worth it." She was likable. I'd give her that. "Tell me your name," I said, in part to see if she knew it. "Margaret," she said with a decisive nod. "But I've never liked it. A little old lady-ish. I spent my entire childhood wishing for a nickname." "Tell me where it hurts the most, Margaret." Once I've got their names, I use them over and over because the familiar sound is comforting. "Nowhere," she said. "Nothing hurts. I'm good. Just, you know, stuck, but not uncomfortable." She looked behind me for a second, frowning, and then she said,